Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the magic. I'm delighted to be here and to have the chance to share with you and to hear myself two such distinguished actors as Teresa and Anton reading snippets of some of my favourite children's classics. I'm sure that they, if not I, will dispel any lingering ideas you may have that classics can be difficult or dull. In fact, to whet your appetite, I'm going to ask them to read a selection of famous first lines from classic children's books. See how many you can identify.
"Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents," grumbled Joe, lying on the rug.
The mole had been working very hard all the morning, spring cleaning his little home.
They were not railway children to begin with.
The first place that I can well remember was a large, pleasant meadow with a pond of clear water in it.
Dorothy lived in the midst of the great Kansas prairies with Uncle Henry, who was a farmer, and Aunt Em, who was the farmer's wife.
Once there were four children whose names were Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy.
All children except one grow up.
"In the sea, once upon a time, oh, my best beloved, there was a whale, and he ate fishes."
When Mary Lennox was sent to Misselthwaite Manor to live with her uncle, everybody said she was the most disagreeable-looking child ever seen.
Alice was beginning to get very tired of sitting by her sister on the bank and of having nothing to do. Once or twice she had peeped into the book her sister was reading, but it had no pictures or conversations in it. "What is the use of a book," thought Alice, "without pictures or conversations?"
At least some of them are not too difficult to recognise, are they? Little Women, The Wind in the Willows, The Railway Children, Black Beauty, The Wizard of Oz, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Peter Pan, The Just So Stories, The Secret Garden, and Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. Also, this reminds us, they don't have difficult openings either. Resonant as they are to us now, not one of these is expressed in anything but the most straightforward language. There's nothing intimidating about them at all. Classics can get a much worse press than they deserve. As a reviewer of children's books, I spend a good deal of my time reading children's books as they are published, trying to draw attention to the best of these, and encouraging people to appreciate contemporary children's literature. I've said, and I happily reiterate, that we are living now in a golden age of children's books, when the best of what is being published are remarkable works of art and literature that we often do not value enough. So why should I be standing here singing the praises of dead authors and books that in most cases were old-fashioned when I was young? Why wouldn't I suggest that there's enough literary wealth to choose from now, and the past is another country? Well, because great stories go on being great. Because today's wealth is yesterday's legacy. Besides, reading classics gives you a context for more recent books. You know where modern writers got their ideas and how they've played with other people's. Children's classics are windows not only onto history, but onto the history of writing. Also, because the power of these tales and of the way they are told has already found enduring favour. And in my own experience, children respond just as much to old stories as to new stories when they're well told. Children's classics are hard to define. I was part of a discussion recently on Radio 5 Live in which the station had done a vox pop of schoolchildren to find out what they thought of classic books. "Anthony Horowitz's Stormbreaker is a classic," said one boy, using the term precisely as it's defined in Chambers' dictionary, which reveals that colloquially, a classic is something delightful of its kind, such as a good story. I suppose For the purposes of this session, we mean more formally a story that is well established and of the highest quality. It might be ancient, like the Tales of Troy, or nearly 150 years old, like Alice in Wonderland, or only 50, like Alan Garner's Weird Stone of Brisingamen. It might be originally written in another language, like Heidi or Pinocchio or The Little Mermaid. It might be American, like Huckleberry Finn, or Canadian, like Anne of Green Gables, or quintessentially British, like The Wind in the Willows. What confers the status of a classic on a book is that we collectively deem it to be so. This collective awareness is perhaps one reason why classics are valuable. Literature, like any other cultural product, is part of our collective consciousness. If we're ignorant of it, we live in a kind of vacuum where nothing that has been thought or imagined before impinges on our minds. And one of the features of a children's classic is that it changes our mental landscape. It isn't just that it would be strange to live in a world where Peter Pan and Winnie the Pooh didn't exist. It is that our experience of ordinary things is changed by stories. Wardrobes feel different after C.S. Lewis, and walled gardens after Frances Hodgson Burnett. They have associations, and those who don't know the stories are not resonating with the rest of us. That said, classics are not compulsory. I don't recommend them because they are worthy or help you pass exams. They should never be served up as penances or duties. I recommend them because I found them fun and moving and exciting as a child, and I think other children can too. Rather than tracing a formal history of children's classics, because after all, most people's experience of classics is not in chronological order, I'm going to make this a rather personal reflection and selection, and hope that my enthusiasms are catching. I shall begin with an extract from one of those books that changed our mental landscape in a way that we cannot go back on. As I said, for anyone who's read The Secret Garden, there will always be something special about a garden with a wall. The book is the story of grumpy, plain Mary Lennox, orphaned in India, and sent to a northern manor house where her temper and looks are enhanced by the discovery of a garden, closed up since the death of the woman who planted and tended it. The garden, which triggers and symbolizes emotional rebirth, also has the power to transform the life of Mary's wheelchair-bound friend Colin, whose illness has been exacerbated by being deprived of love and fresh air. Mary's other new friend, blue-eyed country boy Dickon, who has a special way with animals, still has a piece of my heart. Here is the moment when Mary first finds the garden.
Mary Lennox had heard a great deal about magic in her Aya stories, and she always said that what happened almost at that moment was magic. One of the nice little gusts of wind rushed down the walk, and it was a stronger one than the rest. It was strong enough to wave the branches of the trees, and it was more than strong enough to sway the trailing sprays of untrimmed ivy hanging from the wall. Mary had stepped close to the robin, and suddenly the gust of wind swung aside some loose ivy trails. And more suddenly still, she jumped toward it and caught it in her hand. This she did because she had seen something under it, a round knob, which had been covered by the leaves hanging over it. It was the knob of a door. She put her hands under the leaves and began to pull and push them aside. Thick as the ivy hung, it nearly all was a loose and swinging curtain, though some had crept over wood and iron. Mary's heart began to thump, and her hands to shake a little in her delight and excitement. The robin kept singing and twittering away, and tilting his head on one side, as if he were as excited as she was. What was this under her hands which was square and made of iron, and which her fingers found a hole in? It was the lock of the door, which had been closed 10 years, and she put her hand in her pocket, drew out the key, and found it fitted the keyhole. She put the key in and turned it. It took two hands to do it, but it did turn. And then she took a long breath and looked behind her up the long walk to see if anyone was coming. No one was coming. No one ever did come, it seemed. And she took another long breath because she could not help it. And she held back the swinging curtain of ivy and pushed back the door, which opened slowly. Slowly. Then she slipped through it and shut it behind her and stood with her back against it, looking about her and breathing quite fast with excitement and wonder and delight. She was standing inside the secret garden.
And here is the moment, months later, when Mary and Dickon first show the garden to Colin.
Dickon stood still and the wheelchair stopped. "And this," said Mary, stepping on the bed close to the ivy, "is where I went to talk to him when he chirped at me from the top of the wall. And this is the ivy the wind blew back." And she took hold of the hanging green curtain.
"Oh! Is it? Is it?"
gasped Colin. "And here's the handle, and here's the door. Dickon, push him in. Push him in quickly." And Dickon did it with one strong, steady, splendid push. But Colin had actually dropped back against his cushions, even though he gasped with delight, and he had covered his eyes with his hands and held them there, shutting out everything until they were inside and the chair stopped as if by magic and the door was closed. Not till then did he take them away and look round and round and round as Dickon and Mary had done. And over walls and earth and trees and swinging sprays and tendrils, the fair green veil of tender little leaves had crept. And in the grass under the trees and the grey urns in the alcoves, and here and there and everywhere, were touches or splashes of gold and purple and white. And the trees were showing pink and snow above his head. And there were fluttering of wings and faint sweet pipes and humming and scents. And the sun fell warm upon his face, like a hand with a lovely touch. And in wonder, Mary and Dickon stood and stared at him. He looked so strange and different, because a pink glow of colour had actually crept all over him, ivory face and hands and neck and all. "I shall get well! I shall get well!" he cried out. "Mary, Dickon, I shall get well! And I shall live forever! And ever and ever!"
Frances Hodgson Burnett could be sentimental and repetitive in her use of language, but she knew how to use a door. Portals of all kinds have always been powerful in children's literature, sometimes real doors like this one, but more often portals into magic lands, the rabbit hole that is the entrance to Wonderland, the wardrobe that leads to Narnia, the farmhouse door that Dorothy opens to Oz, the ruined archway in Alan Garner's Elidor, platform 9 3/4, and the back wall of the yard of the Leaky Cauldron. And each one of them owes something to the ones that have gone before, just as every book owes something to its predecessors. And the books themselves are doorways. The more you open, the more of a view you get of the whole picture. Now, it's time for something less soppy than Colin and the Flowers. I've chosen one of the most chilling incidents that I remember as a child from classic literature, from Treasure Island. After the sudden death of his father, young Jim Hawkins has been ordered to let no one near the sick captain who is staying in his family's pub and fears the delivery of the black spot. But a stranger arrives, who we learn later is Blind Pew.
So things passed. Until the day after the funeral, and about 3 o'clock of a bitter, foggy, frosty afternoon, I was standing at the door for a moment, full of sad thoughts about my father, when I saw someone drawing slowly near along the road. He was plainly blind, for he tapped before him with a stick, and wore a great green shade over his eyes and nose. And he was hunched, as if with age or weakness, and wore a huge old tattered sea cloak with a hood that made him appear positively deformed.
I never saw in my life a more dreadful-looking figure. He stopped a little from the inn, and raising his voice in an odd sing-song, addressed the air in front of him. Will any kind friend inform a poor old blind man who has lost the precious sight of his eyes and the gracious defence of his native country, England, and God bless King George, where or in what part of this country he may now be? You are at the Admiral Benbow, Blackhill Cove, my good man, said I. I hear a voice, said he. A young voice. Will you give me your hand, my kind young friend, and lead me in? I held out my hand, and the horrible, soft-spoken, eyeless creature gripped it in a moment like a vice. I was so much startled that I struggled to withdraw, but the blind man pulled me close up to him with a single action of his arm. Now, boy, he said, take me into the captain. Sir, said I, upon my word, I dare not. Oh, he sneered. That's it. Take me in straight, or I'll break your arm. And he gave it, as he spoke, a wrench that made me cry out. Sir, said I, it is for yourself. I mean, the captain is not what he used to be. He sits with a drawn cutlass. Another gentleman... Come out! March! He interrupted. And I never heard a voice so cruel and cold and ugly as that blind man's. It cowed me more than the pain, and I began to obey him at once, walking straight in at the door and towards the parlour, where our sick old buccaneer was sitting, dazed with rum. The blind man clung close to me, holding me in one iron fist and leaning almost more of his weight on me than I could carry. Lead me straight up to him, and when I'm in view, cry out. Here's a friend for you, Bill. If you don't, I'll do this. And with that, he gave me a twitch that I thought would have made me faint. Between this and that, I was so utterly terrified of the blind beggar that I forgot my terror of the captain. And as I opened the parlour door, cried out the words he had ordered in a trembling voice. The poor captain raised his eyes, and at one look the rum went out of him and left him staring sober. The expression of his face was not so much of terror as of mortal sickness. He made a movement to rise, but I do not believe he had enough force left in his body.
Now, well, sit where you are, said the beggar. If I can't see, I can hear a finger stirring. Business is business. Hold out your left hand, boy. Take his left hand by the wrist and bring it near to my right.
We both obeyed him to the letter, and I saw him pass something from the hollow of the hand that held his stick into the palm of the captain's, which closed upon it instantly.
And now that's done, said the blind man.
And at the words, he suddenly left hold of me, and with incredible accuracy and nimbleness, skipped out of the parlour and into the road, where, as I still stood motionless, I could hear his stick go tap, tap, tapping into the distance. It was some time before either I or the captain seemed to gather our senses, but at length, and at about the same time, I released his wrist, which I was still holding, and he drew in his hand and looked sharply into the palm.
10 o'clock, he cried. 6 hours, we'll do them yet.
And he sprang to his feet. Even as he did so, he reeled, put his hand to his throat, stood swaying for a moment, and then, with a peculiar sound, fell from his whole height, face foremost, to the floor.
Treasure Island, I think, now sounds surprisingly modern, despite its 18th century setting and the fact that it was written in 1883, not least because of the way it handles menace. Which brings me to another thought about classic literature. that we're in more of a mood to be receptive to it now than we have been for some time. There was a vogue in the 1980s and 90s, for gritty realism in children's books. And in the era of Goosebumps and Sweet Valley High, the literature most people seem to be interested in was populist and easy. We still have accessible bestsellers and contemporary stories and issue books, but in the genre of children's literature, the stakes have been raised by the likes of Philip Pullman and Meg Rozoff, who write for an audience that can just as well be adults as children. Sophistication and big themes are back in fashion. So post-Harry, are fat books and fantasy. It's no coincidence that ours is the moment when the Lord of the Rings and the Narnia books have been filmed. And we've turned back to history. Sally Gardner, Michael Morpurgo, Philip Reeve, Marcus Sedgwick, Elizabeth Laird, Kevin Crossley Holland, for instance, some of our finest contemporary writers go there. For children who've encountered these writers, the transition to classics is less than it would have been for readers raised on a diet of Judy Blume. Writers who borrow from the finest tradition of children's literature are making that literature more accessible. Even J.K. Rowling is steeped in classical myths. Not since Kay Webb kept the work of E. Nesbitt alive by publishing it on the Puffin list in the 1960s, beside such writers as Leon Garfield and Cynthia Hartnett, Joan Aitken, Rosemary Sutcliffe and Geoffrey Treece, has there been so much in common between contemporary and classic children's books. You might find children hardly noticing the difference. However, my enthusiasm has possibly made me avoid the truth that there are children who are deterred from reading classics. Sometimes it's because they only encounter them through school reading lists, which make them seem like work. I approve of such lists, but sadly they can be a bit of a dead hand. Some children find the language challenging, some even after Harry find classics too long. And sometimes it's true, voices of another era embed homilies and asides that can sound dated and moralizing. As my teenage daughter put it, classics can seem uncool and need to shake their image. Some publishers, such as Puffin, with their recently relaunched classics list, are doing their best with new introductions by popular living authors, abridgments and updated jackets. Although traditional covers are popular again too, if you think of, say, the design of The Dangerous Book for Boys. Some adults unwisely thrust books children should read at them, as if they were a moral imperative. But coercion is counterproductive. Bribery might work to kickstart a child on a book, but it shouldn't have to come to that. There's a better way. I hope the readings you've already heard have brought to mind another means of making classics appeal to children. Hearing them. Being read to is always seductive, and we can often listen at a more sophisticated level than we can comfortably read. If you're going to read aloud yourself, you can edit and explain. But if you do, pick a book you genuinely like. If it's a chore to you, it will also be to the listener. Less interactive than reading aloud, but also effective, is letting children listen to the experts do it. Audiobooks can help. And if you have a CD player in your car, you have a captive audience on long journeys, and the drivers are entertained too. Or if you download onto computers and MP3 players and iPods, any modernity that is missing from the message is compensated for by the medium. Anyone who frets that this is some kind of cheating should remember that children who listen are also likely to go on to read, and that it gives children the same access to language and story and the common cultural pool that reading does, and that listening is not passive in the way that television is, because the images are still being created in your head, and that listening itself is a valuable skill. Audiobooks can help too if you aren't so great at accents. Teresa has read Heidi on CD. This snippet might suggest that she can do something you can't. Heidi, you might remember, is an orphan looked after by her reluctant Aunt Deity, who dumps her up a mountain with her odd and reclusive grandfather. Here is Deity and Heidi's first arrival at the grandfather's accompanied by Peter the goatherd.
Peter willingly undertook to do this, and followed after her on his bare feet with his left arm round the bundle and the right swinging his goatherd stick, while Heidi and the goats went skipping and jumping joyfully beside him. After a climb of more than 3/4 of an hour, they reached the top of the Alm Mountain. Uncle's hut stood on a projection of the rock, exposed indeed to the winds, but where every ray of sun could rest upon it, and a full view could be had of the valley beneath. Behind the hut stood 3 old fir trees with long, thick, unlopped branches. Beyond these rose a further wall of mountain, the lower heights still overgrown with beautiful grass and plants, above which were stonier slopes covered only with shrub that led gradually up to the steep, bare, rocky summits. Against the hut, on the side looking towards the valley, Uncle had put up a seat. Here he was sitting, his pipe in his mouth and his hands on his knees, quietly looking out, when the children, the goats, and Cousin Detty suddenly clambered into view. Heidi was at the top first. She went straight up to the old man, put out her hand and said, "Good evening, Grandfather."
So what is the meaning of this?"
he asked gruffly, as he gave the child an abrupt shake of the hand, and gazed long and scrutinizingly at her from under his bushy eyebrows. Heidi stared steadily back at him in return, with unflinching gaze. For the grandfather, with his long beard and thick grey eyebrows that grew together over his nose and looked just like a bush, was such a remarkable appearance that Heidi was unable to take her eyes off him. Meanwhile, Daddy had come up, with Peter after her, and the latter now stood still a while to watch what was going on.
"I wish you good day, Uncle," said Daddy as she walked towards him. "And I brought you Tobias and Adelaide's child. You will hardly recognize her if you have never seen her since she was a year old."
"And what has the child to do with me up here?"
asked the old man curtly.
"You there!" he then called out to Peter. "Be off with your goats. You're none too early as it is, and take mine with you."
Peter obeyed on the instant and quickly disappeared, for the old man had given him a look that made him feel that he did not want to stay any longer. "The child is here to remain with you," Detty made answer. "I have, I think, done my duty by her these 4 years, and now it is time for you to do yours."
"That's it, is it?"
said the old man as he looked at her with a flash in his eye.
"And when the child begins to fret and whine after you, as is the way with these unreasonable little beings, what am I to do with her then?"
"That's your affair," retorted Detty. "I know I had to put up with her without complaint when she was left on my hands as an infant, and with enough to do as it was for my mother and self. Now I have to go and look after my own earnings, and you are the next of kin to the child. If you cannot arrange to keep her, do with her as you like. You will be answerable for the result if harm happens to her, though you have hardly need, I should think, to add to the burden already on your conscience." Now, Detty was not quite easy in her own conscience about what she was doing, and consequently was feeling hot and irritable, and said more than she had intended. As she uttered her last words, Uncle rose from his seat. He looked at her in a way that made her draw back a step or two. Then, flinging out his arm, he said to her in a commanding voice,
"Be off with you this instant, and get back as quickly as you can to the place whence you came, and do not let me see your face again in a hurry."
Detty did not wait to be told twice. "Goodbye to you, then. And to you, Heidi," she called as she turned quickly away and started to descend the mountain at a running pace, which she did not slacken till she found herself safely again in Dorfley.
Heidi, I'm afraid, is another of those stories which suggests, like The Secret Garden, that all you need to make a wheelchair redundant is love and fresh air. But it makes up for it with its characterization and a surprising sense of irony. Some books especially lend themselves to performance. Oscar Wilde, for instance, has a theatricality even in his stories. Here's just a snippet of the opening of The Happy Prince, which Anton has read on audiobook.
High above the city, on a tall column, stood the statue of the Happy Prince. He was gilded all over with thin leaves of fine gold,
For eyes, he had two bright sapphires, and a large red ruby glowed on his sword hilt. He was very much admired indeed.
"He is as beautiful as a weathercock," remarked one of the town councillors, who wished to gain a reputation for having artistic tastes.
"Only not quite so useful," he added, fearing lest people should think him unpractical, which he really was not.
"Why can't you be like the happy prince?" asked a sensible mother of her little boy who was crying for the moon. "The happy prince never dreams of crying for anything."
"I am glad there is someone in the world who is quite happy," muttered a disappointed man as he gazed at the wonderful statue.
"He looks just like an angel,"
said the charity children as they came out of the cathedral in their bright scarlet cloaks and their clean white pinafores.
"How do you know?"
said the mathematical master.
"You've never seen one."
"Ah, but we have, in our dreams,"
answered the children. And the mathematical master frowned and looked very severe, for he did not approve of children dreaming.
Who would not want to know more? I read this story through to the end the other day, aloud to a teenage daughter. As you may remember, it has, like that other great wild short story, The Selfish Giant, a sad ending redeemed by a Christian message. I have no religious faith, but it brought tears to my eyes and a lump to my throat and to my daughter's. Sometimes fiction can bypass the issue of whether you actually hold any attitude or belief, so it doesn't matter if a story is a product of another time or place or creed. In fact, it's an advantage, because it's a way of going there. Sometimes the most powerful thing that stays with you from a book is a mere line. In the Winnie the Pooh books, for me, it's the last line of The House at Pooh Corner. In that enchanted place in the middle of the forest, a little boy and his bear will always be playing. There's also a line in Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer. For many, the more memorable part of the book is Tom's adventures tracking Injun Joe with his wild friend Huck Finn and being lost in a cave. But when I was a child, I remembered best the scene in which Tom takes two whippings for crimes he didn't commit. The first time, it's because his schoolmate Alfred Temple has spilt ink onto Tom's spelling book. Becky Thatcher, who used to be sweet on Tom, knows Alfred is the guilty one and doesn't say so because she and Tom have had a tiff. The second flogging Tom takes on Becky's behalf, knowing that it was she who tore a page from an anatomy book on the teacher's desk, a page, as it happens, that had a nude figure on it. Here is the moment of Tom's confession as the teacher seeks the culprit.
The next girl was Becky Thatcher. Tom was trembling from head to foot with excitement and a sense of the hopelessness of the situation.
"Rebecca Thatcher."
Tom glanced at her face. It was white with terror.
"Did you tear? No, look me in the face."
Her hands rose in appeal.
"Did you tear this book?"
A thought shot like lightning through Tom's brain. He sprang to his feet and shouted, "I done it!" The school stared in perplexity at this incredible folly. Tom stood a moment to gather at his dismembered faculties. And when he stepped forward to go to his punishment, the surprise, the gratitude, the adoration that shone upon him out of poor Becky's eyes seemed pay enough for 100 floggings. Inspired by the splendor of his own act, he took without an outcry the most merciless flaying that even Mr. Dobbins had ever administered, and also received with indifference the added cruelty of a command to remain 2 hours after school should be dismissed. For he knew who would wait for him outside till his captivity was done, and not count the tedious time as loss either. Tom went to bed that night planning vengeance against Alfred Temple, for with a shame and repentance, Becky had told him all, not forgetting her own treachery.
But even the longing for vengeance had to give way soon to pleasanter musings. And he fell asleep at last with Becky's latest words, lingering dreamily in his ears. Tom, how could you be so noble?
I'm afraid that line, how could you be so noble, is one of the reasons why my elder daughter is called Rebecca. Though she might not have been if I had remembered that Becky's surname is Thatcher. But I shall finish with an all-time favourite, a favourite bit of a favourite book, which perhaps turns out to be apt for the weather that we had this morning. There are two chapters in The Wind in the Willows that exist almost separately from the central plot about boastful Toad's adventures and his rescue by his friends. One is Dulce Domum, and it's about the pull of home and our very powerful ties to where we've come from. The other is Wayfarers All, in which Ratty is almost seduced away from the river by the traveller's tales of a seafaring rat. It's about our desire to go away and have adventures and see and experience everything. Both those are central to what childhood is all about, being attached to home and moving on. And both these impulses, to belong and to live independent, exciting lives, are things I think that none of us ever grows out of. So this part, when Mole, who left his home in the spring, is walking through the snow the following winter with Ratty and suddenly comes across the smell of his home, is for anyone who knows where their heart is.
They plodded along steadily and silently, each of them thinking his own thoughts. The Moles ran a good deal on supper. As it was pitch dark, and it was all a strange country for him as far as he knew, and he was following obediently in the wake of the rat, leaving the guidance entirely to him. As for the rat, he was walking a little way ahead, as his habit was, his shoulders humped, his eyes fixed on the straight grey road in front of him. So he did not notice poor Mole, when suddenly the summons reached him and took him like an electric shock. We others, who have long lost the more subtle of the physical senses, have not even proper terms to express an animal's intercommunications with his surroundings, living or otherwise, and have only the word smell, for instance, to include the whole range of delicate thrills which murmur in the nose of the animal night and day, summoning, warning, inciting, repelling. It was one of those mysterious fairy calls from out the void that suddenly reached Mole in the darkness, making him tingle through and through with its very familiar appeal, even while yet he could not clearly remember what it was. He stopped dead in his tracks, his nose searching hither and thither in its efforts to recapture the fine filament, the telegraphic current that had so strongly moved him. A moment, and he had caught it again, and with it, this time, came recollection in fullest flood. Home. That was what they meant. Those caressing appeals, those soft touches wafted through the air, those invisible little hands pulling and tugging all one way. Why, it must be quite close by him at the moment, his old home that he had hurriedly forsaken and never sought again that day when he first found the river. And now it was sending out its scouts and its messengers to capture him and bring him in. Since his escape, on that bright morning, he had hardly given it a thought, so absorbed had he been in his new life and all its pleasures, its surprises, its fresh and captivating experiences. Now, with a rush of old memories, how clearly it stood before him in the darkness. Shabby indeed, and small and poorly furnished, and yet his. The home he had made for himself, the home he had been so happy to get back to after his day's work. The home had been happy with him, too, evidently, and was missing him, and wanted him back, and was telling him so, through his nose, sorrowfully, reproachfully,
but with no bitterness or anger, only with plaintive reminder that it was there and wanted him. The call was clear. The summons was plain. He must obey it instantly and go.
Ratty!
He called, full of joyful excitement.
Hold on! Come back! I want you! Quick! Oh, come along, Moldew! Replied the rat cheerfully, still plodding along. Please stop, Ratty!
Pleaded the poor mole in anguish of heart.
You don't understand. It's my home, my old home. I've just come across the smell of it, and it's close by here, really quite close, and I must go to it. I must. Oh, come back, Ratty. Please come back.
The rat was by this time very far ahead, too far to hear clearly what the mole was calling, too far to catch the sharp note of painful appeal in his voice. And he was much taken up with the weather, for he too could smell something, something suspiciously like approaching snow.
Mole, we mustn't stop now, really, he called back. We'll come for it tomorrow, whatever it is you've found, but I daren't stop now. It's late and the snow's coming on again and I'm not sure of the way. And I want your nose, Mole, so come on, quick, there's a good fellow.
And the rat pressed forward on his way, without waiting for an answer. Poor Mole stood alone in the road, his heart torn asunder, and a big sob gathering somewhere low down inside him, to leap up to the surface presently, he knew, in passionate escape. But even under such a test as this, his loyalty to his friend stood firm. Never for a moment did he dream of abandoning him. Meanwhile, the wafts from his old home pleaded, whispered, conjured, and finally claimed him imperiously. He dared not tarry longer within their magic circle. With a wrench that tore his very heartstrings, he set his face down the road and followed submissively in the track of the rat, while faint, thin little smells, still dogging his retreating nose, reproached him for his new friendship and his callous forgetfulness.
Preparing this presentation has made me want to reread or listen again to every single book I've mentioned. I invite you to go away and consider which bits of the classics you would have selected. Make your own choice, and if you're already grown up, see if you can impart your enthusiasm to a child. Thank you.